Welcome to the first strong gravity seminar of 2021. Our speaker today is Chris from AEI, and he will talk about black hole perturbation theory and gravitational wave source modeling. So, Chris, please take it away.
Hey, thank you, and thanks very much for the invitation. I'm very happy to be giving the first seminar of the year. Happy New Year, everybody. So there's kind of two main things I'm going to be talking about. The first, which I'll probably spend most of the time on, is I guess what I've been working on for many years, which is the modeling of extreme mass ratio in spirals. I imagine these objects are quite familiar to most of this audience, but in case they're not, so they are binary black holes, so binary compact binary systems where you have a central black hole, which is typically a kind of galactic center type black hole with 10 to the 6 solar masses. And orbiting it, you have a much smaller black hole, maybe 10 solar masses, 30 solar masses, whatever. And it typically follows in short time scales, something like a Kerr GD6. So that's what I plotted here. And I'm mostly going to focus on analytic methods in modeling extreme mass ratio in spirals and asymptotic expansions. And that will kind of naturally lead to talking about the interactions between Emery modeling using self-force and other weak field approximations, namely post-Newtonian theory. And we're going to talk about how self-force has influenced determining things for PN, namely spin dependencies, and then ultimately we'll get to, I guess, some recent interactions between binary black hole modeling and quantum scattering methods. And then towards the end, I'll spend some time on a project I've been working on over the past year with some people local to Perimeter, Fabian Bautista and Alfredo Guevara, on relating a process in black hole perturbation theory, namely wave scattering in Kerr spacetime, to something in particle physics, which is the scattering of gravitons of massive spinning particles. It turns out these processes are quite related and can be used to help each other. Okay, so my main objective is to get to these two things and be able to say something informative about both of them. Before we get to that, I'll just quickly spend a few minutes talking about gravitational waves as a science. I imagine everybody knows a lot about this, so I'll try and go pretty quickly, but you know, it's good to start off the new year talking about this stuff. So, of course, don't need to introduce the network of ground-based detectors, LIGO, Virgo, and now CAGRA, and all of the really, really exciting stuff that they've been putting out over the past few years. I mean, I'll just mention the kind of a couple of things we've seen. We've seen probes of kind of the dense nuclear matter in neutron stars informing models of stellar evolution, constraining GR, and now beginning to measure the Hubble constant independently to electromagnetic observations. And kind of one set of plots I get that I guess that have really blown my mind, at least over the past years, has been these plots where, oops, they're showing the kind of set of black holes and neutron stars, which have been observed A, by electromagnetics, so namely the purple and yellow, and then by gravitational waves, which is the blue ones. And I mean, just a couple of years ago, this plot came out, and it kind of surprised me that already gravitational waves had made such a huge mark on the known black holes in the universe. And then just a couple of months ago, with the most recent catalog, I mean, this thing just exploded. I mean, we can really see how rapidly gravitational waves are kind of evolving and growing as a field. But kind of most of my work is looking a bit more forward and past the current generation of gravitational wave detectors to one of the space-based gravitational wave detectors proposed, which is LISA, the Laser Interferometer Space Antenna. So following the kind of huge success of LIGO and its first detections in 2016, LISA was selected by the European Space Agency for one of their large missions, their L3 missions. And the launch date was set around 2034. Just kind of a gist of this, it's basically three spacecraft with lasers shooting between them, kind of forming overlapping Michelson interferometers. The big difference with LIGO and other ground-based detectors is the arm length. So these arm lengths are going to be around 2.5 million kilometers. The result of that is that the gravitational waves detected are much lower frequency. And with those lower frequency comes a really large selection of new and exciting sources. So this plot, which is a little bit busy, is going to aim to kind of give an idea of what kind of things LISA will be seeing. So it's a plot, let me just get rid of this, of frequency on the x-axis and amplitude of gravitational wave essentially on the y-axis. And what you want to see is everything above this green line is what LISA will detect. Okay, so what kind of things are we going to be seeing? Well, all these thousands of little points here are galactic binaries, so things within the Milky Way. things like white dwarfs, neutron stars, binary black holes, combinations thereof. They're going to be individually resolving tens of thousands of these and really mapping out the population throughout the Milky Way. These big streaks are time evolutions of massive black hole binaries. So binaries like what LIGO sees, except you're going to ramp up the mass to maybe 10 to the 3, 10 to the 8 solar masses. And these binaries will kind of streak in, be huge SNRs, and then merge within the LISA band. And they give really clean in-spiral merger ring down signals, allowing a lot of science to be done. Like I mentioned, extreme mass ratio in spirals. So that's a set of tracks. This is a single emery and it's different harmonics. Like I said, these are occur in galactic nuclei where you have a big black hole and some dense environment of smaller mass compact objects, and something gets scattered in and caught by that central black hole. Then these streaks here are LIGO binaries. So smaller mass ratio binaries, 30, 60 solar masses, much, much earlier in their in-spiral than LIGO sees, so much, much more lower frequency. And LISA would see them early, and then they would leave after a time, LISA band, and after some time, enter the higher frequency, or the lower higher frequency LIGO band down here. And LISA will then be able to say, like, from its observations here, LISA will be able to say, on this day, on this time, you will see a merger. And all of this kind of is going to enable a bunch of fundamental physics to be done and a bunch of astrophysics, things like testing the Noherian theorems, Kerr quadrupole moment, bounds on Lorentz violation, graviton masses. The Hubble parameter is going to be able to be measured for a huge variety of redshifts from different sources and extremely accurately. The stochastic gravitational wave background, cosmic strings, unknown sources that we don't know, triple systems, what have you, whatever you can really think of in this frequency regime. Okay, so back to waveform modeling, because that's really what I'm going to be talking about. So what do these new sources mean for people doing waveform modeling when compared to what we're currently dealing with? Well, it's expected that a lot of these sources are going to have more eccentricity. It won't be circularized by the time they get to LISA band. Signals are going to be much longer, lower frequency. They're going to last for years inside LISA's band. Higher SNRs means any errors in your model will stand out. Errors need to be really significantly reduced. The spins will be much more dynamical. You'll have many, many more misaligned spins, whatever. And mass ratios, well, everything from equal masses to these extreme mass ratio in spirals will need to be modeled. And even if you have all these waveform models, there's a lot of fun to be had for the data analysis community, because all of these signals will be occurring simultaneously and will have to be extracted at the same time from the data stream. Okay, so now back to emeries specifically. They will typically, or they're expected to be within the LISA band for years. They'll undergo thousands, tens of thousands of wave cycles before merging or disappearing. They are approximately Kerr GUD6, not necessarily equatorial. And so they'll exhibit three independent frequencies, all of which will be slowly evolving, and they can exhibit resonances. In order to track it accurately for all of these wave cycles, we'll need to go to very high accuracy in the perturbation theory, and the perturbation theory I'll describe later. And we'll have to go specifically to second order. What you get for this is some extreme accuracy on measuring the intrinsic parameters of the binary system. So you'll get many digits of precision on the masses, on the eccentricities, and many digits on the spin of the bigger black hole. With this, there's a big payoff for both for astrophysics, for physics of the central black hole. So we're going to be able to learn things about the distribution of masses in the big galactic central black holes and their spins. We're going to be able to, based on the event rates and the parameters of the smaller body, we're going to learn things about the surrounding medium of galactic center black holes. And likewise, there'll be opportunities to do some real extreme precision tests of general relativity, because if there is a deviation from GR, the many, many cycles an emery undergoes will amplify these deviations, and you'll be able to see them in the waveform if they are there, or constrain at least the deviations very strongly. Okay, so now I'm going to spend a couple of slides talking about gravitational wave source modeling in general. So I'll spend maybe one slide on each of the kind of main methods used for modeling binary systems. And the aim is to give kind of context for when I start talking about emery modeling, and kind of allow us to talk, make it easier to talk about the interactions between emery modeling and other methods. So in general, in source modeling, the problem is the same no matter what you're doing. So you have two compact objects, And what you want to do is describe their world lines, gamma one and gamma two, and then ultimately determine the asymptotic metric or waveform, because this will be a function of the two world lines. And to do this, you of course solve Einstein field equations. And the big thing that's very important is that it is essential to solve this for a vast array of configurations in order to be able to do the data analysis. So you don't just need to be able to solve the field equations, you need to be able to do it extremely efficiently. Okay, so the first method I'm going to talk about is numerical relativity. I'm sure everybody knows a bit about this. And I guess compressing this very large, complicated, and impressive field into a single sentence, it is putting general relativity onto a grid. So you use finite differencing or spectral methods to solve the field equations and evolve the binary. The real big advantage of NR is that you are solving the full nonlinear field equations. You're not making any approximations there. The only approximation is your resolution. This allows you to get kind of the entire in-spiral, merger, and ring down in one kind of continuous, consistent framework without doing any patching, and gives you very good control of your errors, because you just need to do, I guess, some kind of resolution study. The downside is, of course, the computational runtimes, because these are exorbitant. And if you start to introduce any disparate length scales to the problem, like very long in spirals or very large mass ratios, or if the black holes are highly spinning, then these long runtimes just shoot through the roof very quickly and it becomes untenable. But when we introduce these large scales, we typically introduce opportunity for perturbation theory, of course. So the first perturbation theory I'm going to talk about is post-Newtonian theory, or PN. So this is a weak field approximation valid for systems on bound orbits. So you take your binary and you assume that the radius separating them is large, or particularly GM over OR is small with respect to the speed of light. And you also, this is important, assume that the velocity remains small as well, so that the orbits are bound. To enforce these two conditions simultaneously, you can also just set C to be large, or use 1 over C as kind of a dummy expansion parameter. And then you look for perturbative solutions to the field equations about flat space-time. These solutions are given in terms of a time-symmetric piece representing the conservative dynamics, typically written in terms of a Hamiltonian, not always, and this is currently known to fourth post-Newtonian order. And then it's also given a time asymmetric piece, which represents the radiation loss from the system. And this is currently known to 3.5 PN order. As far as I know, I imagine this is going to be extended to 4 pretty soon. And I believe for LISA, it would be ideal to get these at least to 5, but that is looking like a very challenging problem. Another weak field approximation, which is complementary to the PN approximation, is the post-Minkowski approximation, or PM. It's very difficult to, in a talk about PN and PM, so I'll try and do my best. So for PM, you drop the velocity assumption and you allow them to move at arbitrary speeds, so they can whiz past each other and just head back to infinity, not on a bound orbit. But you insist that at all times the separation remains large. So to enforce this, what's typically done is you use Newton's constant as a small parameter, and once again, look for perturbative solutions about flat space-time. One thing I wanted to highlight here is the importance, particularly recently, of the scattering angle in the post-Minkowski approximation. So this is the angle between the asymptotic incoming and outgoing directions. And you'll see this quoted a lot in the literature on PM theory, mostly because of something which has been emphasized by Damore in the past couple of years, but also by others, which is that there is a direct correspondence between the scattering angle and the Hamiltonian. So the scattering angle is a gauge invariant function which actually contains all the information of the Hamiltonian. It tells you everything about the conservative dynamics. So it is ultimately a very important function. Okay, so the state of the art here in the PM approximation is third order in perturbation theory. And this was done in a series of papers over the past year since 2019 really, by Byrne et al, Chung and Solong, and then by Callan, Liu, and Porto. And I think the important thing to emphasize here is that all of these authors come from particle physics backgrounds. And the reason is that this setup is really ideal for a particle physicist. It is two things coming in, interacting briefly, and then going out. So you can kind of picture the Feynman diagram in your head. And these authors have, excuse me, these authors have been applying kind of powerful methods in particle physics and in scattering to push the limits of general relativity calculations for two-body scattering. Okay, so now we get to the small mass ratio approximation, or self-force. So here you make no assumption about the orbital separation. So this approximation is valid whether you are in the weak field or strong field. However, you do make the assumption that the mass of one body is significantly smaller than the other. And then you're going to try and describe the world line of the small body about the central body. And we will look for solutions of the field equations that are not about flat spacetime, but are perturbations to a fixed black hole spacetime, so Schwarzschild or ideally Kerr. And we label these by first order self-force, second order self-force. So if you work in this framework and describe the equations of motion, you find at zeroth order that the world line of this small body, so which is whose four velocity is u, is a GUD6. So it satisfies the normal GUD6 equations you would want it to satisfy if the mass ratio went to zero. At first order, you get the GUD6 equations on the left-hand side, and on the right-hand side, you have a small forcing term. So something which is proportional to the small mass ratio. And this force is a functional of the first order metric perturbation, and that satisfies the linearized Einstein equations on a black hole background. Okay, so I'll spend one slide talking about a kind of computational strategies for doing self-force and for modeling emeries with self-force. So if you look at these two equations, then you quickly find that there is a very challenging problem, which is that the stress energy on the right-hand side of the linearized Einstein equations tells you all about the stress energy of the small body and depends explicitly on its four velocity. So if you want to integrate this equation, you have to simultaneously integrate this equation. And so they are coupled quite strongly. This, however, can be alleviated by noting that this forcing term is small. So for most times, you can say your world line gamma is really a geodesic and then a small correction. And then when you kind of put that in here, you solve the field equations, assuming you're on a geodesic, put that in here, determine a force, and then evolve your orbit one time step onto a kind of new geodesic, and then repeat the process. And what you reduce the self-force problem to is calculating or solving the linearized Einstein equations for all possible relevant GUD6. This idea has been kind of extended and formalized and made valid to all orders in the mass ratio using multi-time scale procedures. And this has been the subject of first work by Flanagan and Hinder in 08, and then a very extensive and significant body of work by Adam Pound since around 2010. Which has laid the ground, laid the foundation for all, well, for the current second order self-force calculations. The kind of important thing I want to take out of this is, and what you learn from doing these, or one of the important things you learn, is that if you were to model an emery and describe the gravitational wave phasing, then you can split what you need to calculate about the self-force into dominant and subdominant pieces, to which you will need to know at varying accuracies. So the dominant and most important piece turns out to be the orbit averaged part of the first order self-force. And if you only knew this, then you could track an emery probably for maybe 2 weeks, and then you would lose phasing and stop accumulating SNR with your waveform. The subdominant pieces after this are, well, the rest of the first order self-force, which includes, say, the conservative self-force and what's called the oscillatory dissipative, and also the orbit averaged second order self-force. If you know these guys as well as this, then you should be able to track an emery for LISA. And just to give you an idea of what we're talking about numerically, it is kind of guessed that you'd need to know this dominant contribution maybe to 8 digits of accuracy, and the subdominant maybe to 3 digits. These numbers are in no way, there has been relatively little work determining precisely what we'll need to know, but they're ballparks. Okay. Now we're going to talk about, I guess, black hole perturbation theory and solving the linearized Einstein equations. So if you just naively wrote them out in a black hole background, you find that you have a second order partial differential equation coupling all the different components of the metric, and you would be a bit scared. And indeed, people were. So this led people to decide that this is probably not the most efficient way to go about doing this problem. And what you should really do is start thinking about maybe including the symmetries you have in your system, and also noting that if you solve this equation, you are solving for something that is gauge dependent, and you will naturally always be including some junk gauge information that you don't necessarily want. So the kind of the approach that has managed to include these kind of key ingredients that is probably most popular is the null tetrad approach of Newman and Penrose. And the aim here is to kind of capture the light cone structure of your spacetime. So what you do is, well, you introduce a set of four vectors. Two of them will capture kind of the radial and time dependence, and two will capture the angular dependence. And these two are complex. And then instead of dealing with tensors, you deal with scalars, which are projections of the tensor onto the tetrad. So for instance, the curvature tensor goes from being 10 components of a tensor to 5 complex scalars. Okay, why is this cool? Well, if you work in a black hole spacetime like Kerr or Schwarzschild, then four of these are identically zero. And your entire Riemann tensor is reduced to a single component, a single complex scalar, psi 2. Surprisingly, this actually gets even better when you go to perturbation theory because what you find is that the perturbations to psi 0 and psi 4, so two of the components, are to linear order gauge invariant. And what's more, they satisfy a separable PDE. Each of them individually satisfies its own separable PDE. And it's been shown that either of them give you all information about non-trivial perturbations to a Kerr spacetime. So from either the calculations, if you solve this PDE, you can get the metric perturbation without solving that coupled second order partial differential equation. So just being a little bit explicit, well, not that explicit, so this is the Tucholsky equation, which is a second order differential operator acting on one of the Weyl scalars, psi 0 or psi 4. And the source is a second order operator on the source for the field equations. So like I said, this guy is separable by making a mode ansatz. And you can essentially write it as a Fourier series and a decomposition over harmonic modes and radial functions. The harmonic modes are well known. They are the spin-weighted spheroidal harmonics. In the Schwarzschild limit, they're reduced to spin-weighted spherical harmonics. And then all you ultimately need to calculate are the radial functions, which satisfy an ODE. So, I mean, the utility of this can't really be overstated because you've reduced the linearized Einstein equations to an ODE and a second order ODE. This equation has been pretty well studied, and some seminal work by Lever and then by Mano, Suzuki, and Togashi wrote down a linearly independent set of homogeneous solutions to the second order ODE. And they're written here, or minus and or plus, and they're written as just analytic expansions of special functions, where these coefficients can be determined fairly easily. So, and the kind of one of the important things about this, what is called MST set of solutions to the Tucholsky equation, is that they each satisfy a physically relevant boundary condition. So or minus satisfies a boundary condition that it is purely ingoing radiation at the horizon. Excuse me. And or plus is purely outgoing radiation at infinity. And then with these two independent solutions, you can construct any inhomogeneous solution you want by standard variation of parameter methods. So just write your solution as a linear combination of the homogeneous solution with normalization coefficients determined by integrating against the source. So what this does is reduces the problem of finding metric perturbation to just doing these sums. So if you're working numerically, what you do is you simply truncate these series at a given n, you just keep summing until you reach a desired numerical accuracy and keep adding terms. These special functions are well known. You can evaluate them very easily. So there's pretty much no problems here. And it's worked out to be a very efficient way of doing black hole perturbation theory. And it is the current method used in the state of the art self-force calculations of first order self-force. However, you don't actually have to do this analytically because these special functions admit Taylor expansions in certain limits. And in particular, they may admit a Taylor expansion in a PN type limit. So if you assume your orbital radius is large and the frequency is small, then you can just write down analytic expansions for those homogeneous solutions, which I write down here. And you can take these pretty much mechanically to any post-Newtonian order you would like. So just for example here, and then from that, you can construct anything you want, this, the metric, the self-force, any other kind of auxiliary gauge invariants you would like to construct from the metric. So for example, here's just a kind of a series of a component of the metric for a circular orbit. And you can take this mechanically to any PN order you would like and achieve any kind of real accuracy you would like. And with this, you can, this kind of idea has been taking in a lot of directions. So a number of authors have been working on computing that dominant piece of the self-force I mentioned in this kind of PN self-force approximation. And they've had quite a lot of success. So in Schwarzschild, these things are known to 10 or sometimes 20 post-Newtonian order to varying degrees of accuracy in an eccentricity expansion. In Kerr, in the literature, there is fourth post-Newtonian expansions for these fluxes for generically inclined orbits valid to epsilon, to the eccentricity to the sixth. And as far as I know, this is probably going to get increased in the near future. And then here is just kind of a comparison of what you would get comparing a kind of PN self-force calculation with a full PN calculation. And what self-force picks up are these terms in blue. And the higher new corrections are higher orders in the mass ratio. The only thing about these calculations of the fluxes is that ultimately you're really going to be limited by the fact that you have a really high constraint on the accuracy you need for them to do every modeling, namely that 8 digits I mentioned. And this approximation breaks down pretty quickly as you enter the strong field, and you will drop below 8 digits very quickly, and they will no longer be sufficient. However, if you were to calculate the other subdominant pieces, such as the conservative self-force, then, which you can, and there has been similar success. So for circular orbits in Schwarzschild, there have been 20 PN results, eccentric, 7 to 9 PN, high order in eccentricity. Likewise in Kerr, there have been high PN order calculations. There is currently nothing for generic orbits, non-equatorial orbits in Kerr, but so I imagine that will be kind of something that will be worked on in the coming years. But since these terms numerically are significantly subdominant, you imagine these high order expansions are going to be far more important for kind of closing off areas of the parameter space for numerics. So, and telling you that, well, if you have an asymptotic expansion that's valid for a large part of the parameter space, you don't have to do any numerics there. And it's important to emphasize that these subdominant pieces are the pieces that are much more difficult for numerics to calculate. So things like I said, conservative self-force, and likewise, it'll be very, very important to get analytic expansions of second order self-force, because numerical calculations of second order self-force are looking extremely difficult. The other application of these analytic expansions has been directly comparing with full PN theory. So if you were to naively do this, so if you were to kind of write down your PN Hamiltonian and then do a kind of analogous calculation in self-force, then self-force would really just pick off the leading order in the mass ratio pieces of each PN order. This is not necessarily very useful if you're interested in using PN to do calculations of systems that have comparable masses. So this doesn't seem like it's necessarily going to be useful. However, an observation by Beeny, DeMore, and Giralico last in 2019 kind of really opened the door for how powerful self-force can be in determining PN information. So what they did was they said, okay, let's use self-force to constrain PN theory. And then let's also take the information we have about PN and compare that with what you get from a post-Minkowski calculation of the scattering angle. Because like I said a while ago, the scattering angle can be directly mapped to the Hamiltonian. And what they find is rather surprisingly that if you had no PN information, you had never done any PN theory, but you had third post-Minkowskian calculations of the scattering angle as Byrne et al. Released, and you had first order self-force, then you would get everything, all orders in mass ratio, to third post-Newtonian order. That's pretty cool, but it's you already know 3PN, so it's not that exciting. But if you have second order self-force as well, then you'll get everything, all orders in mass ratio, to fifth PN. So this gives now a second avenue to calculate the fifth post-Newtonian Hamiltonian, if we can get expansions for a second order self-force Hamiltonian.
So Chris?
Yes.
Yeah, may I ask, so what's behind this? I mean, is there a simple way of understanding this fact?
why this works?
Yep.
Yeah, well, it's, let's see if I can. It ultimately comes down to the structure of the, well, the post-Minkowski approximation, because when you do PN theory and you make this velocity assumption, as well as the large radius assumption, you end up kind of jumbling the expansion up or the dependency on the masses in the expansion. Whereas in the PM expansion, things are much simpler. And what you find is that kind of at each order, or well, the dependence on the mass kind of comes in quite slowly. So at first order, you find that, well, at the leading order, zeroth order in G, you get something that doesn't depend on the mass ratio at all. And at second order, you also get something that still doesn't depend on the mass ratio. And it's not until third order that you start to see dependence on the mass ratio in the scattering angle. And this is just because, and I guess it's, I'm not sure if I have a very quick way of saying how that arises, but it's ultimately because it's just because the expansion is very simple. You just assume you're just expanding in GM over R. So
yeah, I guess maybe what I'm going after, is there a predictive relation? Say I want whatever order in PN, do I know what orders should I know in PM plus what order should I know in cell force to get that equivalence?
Yeah, I'm not sure about the order in cell force. I've heard it stated. I can't fully remember now, but I think to get a given order in PN, you need PM plus one. But if you also have cell force, then you kind of lower that in a sense. But I'm actually not sure. That's a good question. Like if you had third order cell force, how much would you know is your question, kind of.
All right, thank you.
Okay, so yeah, this is a very nice observation. But this was actually not the end of the story, because it turns out that if you add spin to the picture, then the situation is actually even better, because what we showed in some recent work with people at the AEI is that when you start adding perturbatively the spin into the European system, so the spin orbit and then kind of quadratic and spin terms, then with current cell force knowledge and current post-Minkowski knowledge, you could already, by following this kind of procedure, you could already determine new terms in the spin orbit and spin-spin Hamiltonian. And it's going to be kind of interesting to see how far you can take that. So if we go to quadratic and spin, and start doing cell force with quadratic and spin, how much can we really determine about the PN Hamiltonian? Because these terms are going to be very important for doing LISA data analysis and also for 3G ground based detectors. Okay, so that kind of concludes our discussion of Emery physics. And now we're going to talk about this other kind of very related work that I've been doing with Fabian Bautista, Alfredo Guevara, and Justin Vines, relating black hole perturbation theory to kind of more directly to scattering amplitudes. So previously we were using results about binary black holes from scattering amplitudes to constrain PN. Now we're kind of doing a kind of really direct comparison between the two subjects. So what we're going to talk about here is the scattering of a gravitational wave off a Kerr black hole. So it comes in, scatters around, and then you get an outgoing wave going to infinity. And what you want to calculate is kind of the angular profile of the outgoing flux from this process, because that will give you information about the source and the potential. And this is encoded in the differential cross section, which is literally defined as the outgoing flux per solid angle normalized by the incoming flux on the plane wave. So we're going to be doing the scattering about a Kerr black hole with mass M and spin A. And it's going to be important to note that for a physical Kerr black hole with an horizon, this spin A divided by GM has to be between 0 and 1. If A over GM is greater than 1, then you're going to be a super extreme black hole and you'll have a naked singularity. Okay, so the reason this problem is quite tractable for black hole perturbation theory is that, and in fact, more or less fairly straightforward, is that fluxes are given directly in terms of amplitudes of the Weyl scalar, psi 4. So this is the thing that satisfies the Tucholsky equation. So this is exactly what you want to be working with if you're doing black hole perturbation theory. Okay, so this project kind of started by the observation that if you take this system and zoom out, and you do that by taking a long wavelength limit and shrink your black hole kind of down to a particle, then you can kind of see this process as being directly analogous to the classical limit of the scattering of a graviton off a massive spinning particle. And this kind of comes up because it is an idea that's used and conjecturally more or less in every amplitude calculation of binary black holes. And that is the kind of statement that if you take the classical limit of an amplitude calculation of the scattering of a spinning particles, where you take the spin quantum number to zero, then this directly describes the scattering of Kerr black holes. But it does this in a very peculiar limit, which is that A over GM goes to infinity. So this is a super extreme of black hole. And I guess what we want to say is, well, what do we already know about this amplitude? Well, a number of authors have constructed it for spins not to infinity, but s less than or equal to 2. And this gives, it turns out, Kerr to spin to the fourth at leading order in Newton's constant. And the problem is that the construction used by these authors introduces unphysical poles in the amplitude at higher orders in the spin. So it is expected that the construction will need to be fixed by some counterterms at higher orders in the spin. So our idea here is, well, A, let's see if we can verify this conjecture by seeing if this amplitude agrees with the scattering up to spin to the fourth. And then, can if we take this to higher orders in spin, can we fix what this amplitude should be? The reason that would be useful is that this is kind of a very elementary building block for all scattering calculations. So if amplitudes people want to do calculations to higher orders in spin, they will need to know this to higher orders in spin to describe spinning black holes more accurately. Okay, so what time? I'll go through this slide. I wasn't sure if I was gonna have time for it. So how does this calculation proceed for black hole perturbation theory? Well, the situation is actually pretty straightforward. So, and can be done entirely asymptotically. So we never actually need to worry about this kind of very complicated interaction region. Because what we're gonna say is that, well, asymptotically, what's our plane wave gonna look like? If you project a plane wave onto harmonics, you find that it just has the form of a sum of ingoing and outgoing pieces. This was written down by Kronowski and collaborators in 76. And what we're gonna look for is a purely outgoing radial wave as our scattered wave. And what we're gonna wanna determine is what is the amplitude of this scattered wave given this known plane wave solution. How will we do that? Well, we're gonna make the observation that we're gonna be looking for a solution to the Tucholsky equation that is the sum of these two terms. And we're gonna impose the only physical boundary condition we can impose, which is that there's going to be nothing coming out of the horizon. We're going to say this is a solution that is purely radially ingoing at the horizon. And this actually turns out to be an extremely strong constraint because we know what this solution is. It is one of the solutions I wrote down, one of the MST solutions. And asymptotically, that takes a very well-known form of a sum of kind of ingoing and outgoing pieces at infinity. So then all we do is we sum these two, we equate it to this, and then we equate kind of very e to the minus I omega or with e to the minus I omega or, ingoing with ingoing, and solve for this guy. Because that's what we want to know to calculate the outgoing flux. Okay, so that's just the gist of the calculation. And this was really worked out by Master and collaborator in the 70s, and then kind of put in a form using MST language by Dolan in 07 and 08 in some very nice papers. What you find is that your differential cross-section is given by a sum of two terms, the square of two terms, which we write as f and g. And these functions are just sums over harmonics, where you get these f and g functions, which are given in terms of these amplitudes, these MST amplitudes, which we know very well. So our strategy is pretty straightforward. We're just going to basically calculate this. We know these very well from MST, so we're going to do a low frequency expansion to access this long wavelength limit. And we're gonna be a bit careful with the spin at first. We're gonna assume the spin remains fixed for now, and we're not gonna take any large spin limit yet. And what we find then is that we get a power series in the frequency with coefficients, which are functions of the black hole spin. So for the first five terms, you find that you get simple polynomials in the spin. So if you want to pick out the large spin behavior, all you do is take the highest power in the spin. So what does this give you for the differential cross-section? Well, if you take a very simple setting where the incoming wave is down the axis of the curve black hole, then you can write down very easily what the differential cross-section is. It is this here. So before our calculation began, Dolan worked out these first two terms in the expansion, and we have added the next three terms. And then when you do the same calculation by taking the classical limit of the Compton amplitude, you find that this exactly agrees. So this is pretty awesome because, I mean, you would not necessarily think that a particle physics calculation would give you scattering off curve, but we find that it does exactly agree up until a to the fourth. And what's really nice actually about the amplitude calculation is that it doesn't give this as an expansion.
Chris,
yes.
I asked a question. So you said this agreement happens when you take the a goes to infinity limit, but here you didn't take that limit.
So on the previous slide, so we kept these as functions of spin. And then to read out the a goes to infinity limit, we simply picked the highest power of q in these polynomials. Oh. I mean, it's the same thing as taking a spin goes to infinity limit.
Okay.
That will get more explicit in the next slide, though.
Okay.
Good.
Oh, sorry, so, can I push on that a little bit more? Because I'm sort of curious about this limit. And here I see that A is there explicitly in the expression. So have you taken the limit yet, or?
So, I mean, you're essentially taking a G goes to zero limit. And what you have is typically Q. These are the terms where it's kind of A over GM times GM omega, and the G is canceled. Everything else is subleading in G.
Okay, so I'm a little confused about the nature of the limit then. So previously you said that the calculations compare in the spin going to infinity limit.
Yeah, so in the A divided by GM going to infinity limit.
Oh, okay. So it's not. So I shouldn't think of this as spin going to infinity, but as G going to zero.
Yeah, but it's also the same thing as saying spin going to infinity.
That confuses me more because if you start the calculation with imposing horizon conditions,
I completely
and then you go to an extreme limit or a super extreme limit where the horizon disappears, then I don't know what you're doing.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. This is, in some sense, very dodgy. And I think the reason we're doing it is because it's kind of all you can do. So we're taking the function, we're saying it's valid for q between 0 and 1, and then we're saying, okay, we're going to analytically continue that function into a regime it was not originally valid for. And we're assuming that the result we're looking for is the result that smoothly goes between those regions.
Right. So another aspect that always confuses me is that, so because you're taking a low frequency limit, so it's a long wavelength limit, right?
Yes.
And in that limit, the nature of the object at the center shouldn't matter too much, whether it's a black hole or a highly spinning body or anything at all, really. So as long as you have the same spin, the same mass.
Yeah, you would almost think.
Almost.
You very quickly start seeing like very Kerr-like features starting to appear. So maybe I'll get to this on the next slide.
Yeah, that's the source of my confusion because that's my conceptual stumbling block. Physically, the nature of the body shouldn't matter, but all those Kerr features seem to be coming out of this put in a very essential way, and I don't understand why it has to be. But yeah. Sorry for interrupting.
No, they're very, very good points. And I think it is a very concerning point that we are taking a kind of slightly dodgy limit, but time will, I guess, tell whether or not that's the correct thing to do.
Right, and I'm sorry if I'm gonna indulge a bit more. So you said something about spurious poles at order 8^5.
Yes.
Can you say a bit more about that?
Maybe in a second.
Okay.
And I may also defer to my collaborator, who I think is in the call, when we get to that.
Okay, thanks.
Because that is on the amplitude side of the calculation, which I rely wholeheartedly on Alfredo and Fabian for.
Okay, thanks.
So yeah, and typically this calculation should only be valid up to spin to the fifth, but nonetheless, it is written as an exponential, and you would expect correction terms to have to come in at spin to the fifth. So what happens at spin to the fifth? Okay, well, what you see is that the coefficient at the next order is no longer a polynomial in the spin. So you start getting these kind of these transcendental type functions, like the poly gamma function or di gamma function. You get logarithmic dependencies on the spin via this kappa, which is the square root of 1 minus q squared, and you get explicit dependencies on kappa. So now, if you're wanting to read off the high spin limit, you really do have to analytically continue these functions to a large spin limit, or to a g goes to zero limit. When we do that, what we get for the next term is this. Okay, well, that is exactly the next term in this exponential. So what this tells you then is that whatever the problem is in the amplitude, it does not contribute for this specific case of an on-axis scattering. What I can say about off-axis so far is that up to spin to the fourth, we still get this perfect agreement, but we have not yet, well, we've done a matching at spin to the fifth, but we still aren't fully comfortable justifying it. So in this on-axis case, it feels very good that we've done the right thing taking this limit to infinity by seeing this exponential continue.
Chris, just a quick question. Am I missing something? Are the factors, the coefficients the same?
I'm sorry? In these two?
Yeah.
So yeah, they're actually the same.
Okay. Well, with the bottom expression. I mean, I see the right powers in the sines and the cosines, but is it also the factor in front of it?
I'm sorry, which two do you mean, this one and this one?
Yeah.
Yeah, if you expand this, I guess in A omega, you get this. Or did I do something wrong?
No, I don't see the 1/15, but I take your word, that's okay.
1/15.
That's okay, don't worry.
Oh, if you take this to fifth order, you don't get this.
I know, I'm trying to do it quickly in my head, and then so somehow I don't get the 1/15, but that's fine, don't worry.
You can go to fifth order in your head? Oh, I guess, yeah, factorials. Okay. I'm not sure. Maybe it's a typo. I don't think so, but sorry. Okay, I'm actually going to stop here anyway and head to conclusions. Regarding the spurious poles in the amplitude, I don't know, Fabian, do you want to say something about that quickly?
Yeah, sure.
Thank you very, very much.
So the idea basically is that, you know, we have been using this minimal coupling to construct amplitudes, and this sense of minimal coupling only exists for particles for spinners lower, small or equal to 2. So, but if you say naively expand that, you write an ansatz for the amplitude for higher spin and naively extend your concept of minimal coupling, then you could sort of say that the thing is still an exponential. And it turns out that exponential has unphysical poles. They are not actually, you know, spurious poles. They are unphysical poles that come in there because, you know, you are sort of a right, like using a wrong concept. We don't have the minimal coupling for higher spin bodies. So that's what goes wrong in the amplitude computation. And what we need to do is to sort of find a way of removing those unphysical singularities. And the way of doing so is by adding terms so that when you put those terms together, then those unphysical singularity cancels, and that basically is what gives the match to the black hole perturbation theory computation.
Okay, thank you. And one other thing I might point out, which I guess Eric might be interested in, is that what you see from these functions is actual signs of absorptive effects into the black hole as well. And these are appearing explicitly in our calculations, which is something also you might not expect if you shrank your thing down to zero. But they really can't be ignored, the fact that you are including absorption in this calculation. And they have to be removed before you do any matching to an amplitude, because they're explicitly not including any absorption. Okay, so I guess.
Right, sorry, can I try to understand that? So the
sure.
So that's the result you get from the Kerr calculation, right?
Yeah.
Okay, and then I'm not surprised that you're getting absorption because you're imposing incoming waves at the horizon, so it's got to come out.
Yeah.
And I guess the statement is that when you take the high spin limit, the super extreme limit, then you still have those effects built in, so you don't lose them by taking the limit. But if you started with a super extreme Kerr, you would not have those effects built in. So that's something that says that the ordering of things here matters.
Yeah, exactly.
But in the amplitude calculation, what tells that calculation that you're supposed to get absorption at the horizon, because you don't have a horizon to begin with?
Yeah, I don't know how it's built in. It's not currently. But there's been some recent papers by Goldberger and collaborators including these effects. I'm not sure how they do it though.
So in the amplitude, what you have to do is, sorry to interrupt.
Please.
No, I'm looking for an answer, so please.
Yeah, so I mean, the thing is that these kind of effects enter in a non-local wave. So you couldn't really write down that from an amplitude's point of view. You will have to write down a non-local Lagrangian, and then from that compute scattering amplitude.
You modify your theory to account for the effect.
Exactly. So the way the Goldberger and collaborator does it is, you sort of write an ansatz for the. They do it in the EFT point of view. So they write on an effective word line action, and then you do the match. To match the coefficient of certain operators entering in the Lagrangian. And you do the match to computation of absorption using black hole perturbation theory. And then from that, once you have fixed the coefficient, then you can compute amplitudes. But that's something that is not, elementary in the sense that it's non-local. So it's not built in the amplitudes. So it has to be extended.
Right, okay, so that. I guess that doesn't surprise me. So, yeah, thank you.
Thanks. Okay, so I guess to conclude, things I'd like to emphasize are, well, I think PN self-force is increasingly useful as time goes on. And I think there's still a lot of potential to be explored, particularly in more complicated orbits and Kerr, and especially at second order in the mass ratio. This is going to get really interesting, both for Emery modeling and for its kind of interactions with PN theory and post-Minkowski theory. And I guess this is particularly exciting because results from second order are now beginning to arrive. So the formalism is pretty much ready to start doing these things. And likewise, I think this crossover between perturbation theory and amplitudes is really beginning to look fruitful. And hopefully we're going to have a paper out about that soon enough. Okay, thank you all for listening. That's all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great talk. Thanks, Chris.
I have a pretty naive question. Suppose now I have the following physical scenario where I have a supermassive black hole that is spinning. The object that is seen falling also is spinning. So if I think PN like, okay, I have spin orbit coupling, spin coupling. So how would that work if I then take these limits to infinity? I mean, that, would I not? Is this clear how I'm going to proceed?
So I take which take the spin to infinity limits?
Well, you were doing that, right?
Well, I was doing that for a wave scattering. I was taking the spin of the massive Kerr black hole to infinity.
Right, but so going to your Lisa is 15 years away. That's what Lisa is going to see.
Yes, that is the scenario is for Lisa is a normal black hole, and I would not take the limit of the spin going to infinity for an Emery. Yeah, this is kind of a mathematical tool to do these amplitude calculations.
So how would I take advantage of?
Well, I guess the kind of thing you get
of Lisa. I mean, oh, you're saying that you wouldn't think that this could be applicable.
Well, no, it is applicable. The kind of thing you're doing is, in some sense, you're how to phrase this.
Are you going to use it as an effective tool to compute some coefficients in a different problem that you're going to use for the relevant problem for Lisa?
That is exactly what you do, I think.
Okay. Yeah.
You could compute certain higher spin terms and they kind of build part of the picture, and then you kind of complement that with other calculations ultimately.
Good. All right, thank you.
Like you so simultaneously
go ahead.
You simultaneously get kind of all orders in spin at a given order in G. But what you'd really want is all orders in G. So you have to kind of sequentially build that up. Like some of these terms are not useful on their own until you get the higher order terms that go with them.
Sure, I understand. Thank you.
So back in August, we had this workshop at AEI on the two-body problem. So Lior gave a talk on self-force, and he was describing an effort, ongoing effort, to do a self-force version of the scattering calculation.
Yeah.
Do you know where things stand regarding this?
Yeah, I don't think I haven't heard an update since that conference.
Okay.
Sorry.
No, that's
fine. I guess that was after Kappa, right? So
right.
There is no update as far as I know. They're working to do it numerically, right?
Yeah, that was the hope, and it's a nice calculation because for the for the scattering calculation, you don't have to go to second order because the self force, the accumulated effect of the self force is always small. That's what Leo was saying. So in principle, you could do the calculation through with first order self force and calculate the scattering angle, you know, exactly. So I'm kind of excited about this, but it takes some time to get done.
And that's kind of particularly nice for that mass ratio scaling I was mentioning in the scattering angle, because up until 4th PM, the scattering angle is linear in the mass ratio.
Right, yeah.
So you would if you had the first order correction, you would immediately read off 4 PM.
So Eric, do you mean only the conservative cell force or both the conservative and dissipative piece?
So I'm not sure if Lior had in mind a distinction between conservative versus the full thing, because I mean, when you do self force, typically, I mean, you have everything in hand, right? So, I mean, you can play games and try to isolate just the conservative dynamics if you wish, but you don't have to do that. In fact, it's, you know, it adds complications to do that.
Yeah.
But you know, I don't know how far along they got into that whole business.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll see an update next cover.
So maybe I have one additional question. So can you go back like to the previous slide or so? So you had this. So you had this resound series, which looks quite simple. What can you do further with this resound series? So this agrees better with the amplitude calculation, or
Well, this resum series is from the amplitude calculation.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, actually, this yes. So I mean, yeah, there's no. It's hard to see what exactly you can do with this immediately. But it's kind of interesting that the amplitude calculation manages to resum the full black hole perturbation theory calculation, which is quite nice.
But in the lines above, that was the black hole calculation, right? Like,
Yeah. You had to know in advance. Well, you don't know in advance that this is going to be the answer you get by doing the all orders BHPT calculation. And in particular, in the off-axis case, the amplitude calculation can resum what is an entirely non-trivial calculation for black hole perturbation theory. So in the on-axis case, turns out to be a very special case that you can get this series in closed form. But each order in this expansion, I can't get in closed form from the Tucholsky calculation. I get it as an expression of a sum over spin-weighted spheroid harmonics, or spin-weighted harmonics.
Right. So it seems this black hole calculation, right? So you have to still truncate that some powers of A. So you don't.
Yeah, powers of A.
So apparently, right? Like. If you look at higher multiples of the curve, you still are not able to get them. Whereas this amplitude calculation, it seems already contain all multiples of.
Well, not really. If I'm understanding you correctly, I mean, within the black hole perturbation theory calculation, I mean, there's still. Oops, it is. I mean, there are still, for instance, a to the one omega square terms, which you're not getting from the amplitude calculation.
Right.
So amplitude is not getting all occur, for sure. It is only getting the kind of equal powers of a and omega. Likewise, there's an a to the zero omega term.
Yeah, well,
which I'm not writing down here.
Right. So I guess I'm thinking about this conjecture we were talking about, right? So you use this amplitude calculation can get all the multiples of Kerr. If you want to get all the multiples of Kerr, it's like you need all the powers in A.
Yes.
Whereas in this side, you're truncating A. So that means you're not going to.
Okay. I can understand what you're saying. Yeah, and it's just for this special case, it just happens to be that. Yeah, it is curious that that this, despite not apparently having all the multiples of Kerr, it does manage to capture everything.
Yeah.
So I don't think that was expected when we started this.
Yeah.
I think there's something that has to be clarifying here. So, I mean, the amplitude computation that we are doing is just a three-level computation. So this additional factor that appears from the black hole perturbation theory, like, you know, terms a to the zero omega or a one omega square, they will come in the amplitude computation, but they will have to be, you know, a higher loop corrections to the computation of the scattering amplitude. So for the time being, we are just focusing on the three level computation, which is the one that is supposed to give us, you know, give us all the Kerr multiples, but only the one that had, you know, the same power of omega and the same power of A in it.
Yeah. Yeah, they're higher order in G terms. That's what I was trying to write down there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, another question I have, I mean, I'm coming back to what Eric mentioned. In the limit that wavelengths goes to infinity or omega goes to zero, you are not going to be sensitive to the detailed structure of the object inside. Instead, you should be only sensitive to the asymptotic expansion of the metric. Let's say you have a multiple expansion of your metric. Your wave is only sensitive to that. I wonder whether if you do this kind of scattering experiment, right? So you just shoot a wave towards this asymptotic regime of the metric, and maybe it already reflects back all, most of the way, when then you can already get these results you are presenting here. You don't need the internal.
Do you mean like, so you take a Kerr metric, you expand it, and then you do the analysis?
Yeah. So you So you have a metric in the multiple expansion way, and then you do the scattering experiment. Somehow, I don't think your way should be sensitive to what's inside. It should be only when the wavelength is infinity, goes to infinity. Maybe then,
Well, that is something that has been done in the past, actually, by several authors. But the thing is that, I mean, one can show that, you know, the non-spin piece and the linear spin piece is universal. So in the sense that it doesn't really care where you have a Kerr black hole or you have a neutron star, anything. But if you go to higher multiples, you see difference. And what people have computed in the past is this kind of thing that you just described. Not imagine you start off, you span your spherical, rotating spherical symmetric metric, and then sort of do like a scattering computation and compare to what we have done, for instance. And we can recover the linear in the spin pieces, and these are universal. But what we are showing here is that, you know, if you go to high orders in a spin, these are not universal results. And
but the multiples, right? The multiples, let's say the multiple moment of Kerr is not proportional to A, they're proportional to a higher pulse of A. So if you scatter the wave, so that means in the asymptotic regime, if you keep all the multiples, you're keeping a lot of terms that contains higher power in A if you want to stick with the current multiple structure. So you're saying if you do this kind of experiment, you only can only the linear A term will be useful, and the higher power A term will not be useful.
I mean, what I mean is that for the Kerr, it's nice that you just need to know, you know, because the Kerr is an exponential, basically. So you basically need to know what is the exponent.
Mm.
But for, you know, for other objects, like the neutron star or any other things, the multiple structure is not controlled basically by an exponent. You have additional things.
Yeah. So for those objects, you're not going to get that from the scattering?
From the scattering amplitude point of view, you will have like a specialty. I mean, what we are showing here is basically that the minimal coupling gives you the Kerr black hole. Minimal coupling theory gives you Kerr black hole. You want to modify your theory, that gives you other object.
Hmm. Oh, okay. And it's not clear how you modify the theory. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, that is definitely not clear how to do it.
Mm. Okay. Thanks. Is there any other question? Well, if not, let's thank Chris again.
Thank Chris.